We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk show, hour two of the program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is our producer, and Kyle Mabry is at the controls this morning. According to a recently released report, The State of America's Children 2011, America's children of color are behind in nearly every measure of child well-being. This is a report just come out from the Children's Defense Fund. America's children of color are at increased risk of living in poverty, lacking family stability, and lacking a quality education. And those are just a few of the areas that we'll be talking about this morning and that you can read about if you take a look at this report. We'll try in this hour of our show to review some of the findings of this report, although it is very broad and covers a great deal of information and more than we could certainly do in this hour. And I would certainly suggest to people, if you're interested in reading it, you can do that by going to the website of the Children's Defense Fund, and it's there. We have two guests with us this morning. Mary Lee Allen, she is Director of Child Welfare for the Children's Defense Fund, and also Deborah Weinstein, she's the Executive Director of the Coalition on Human Needs. Just a little bit more about them. Mary Lee Allen is Director of the Child Welfare and Mental Health Division of the Fund. She also co-chairs with the Child Welfare League of America, a coalition of national child welfare and mental health organizations, and works regularly with advocates and service providers across the country. Deborah Weinstein is, as I said, she executive director of the Coalition on Human Needs. This is a group that brings together a wide range of other groups, and the Children's Defense Fund is one of them, that try to address the needs of families and individuals in different sorts of ways. Before going to work there at the Coalition on Human Needs, Deborah Weinstein served for a number of years as director of the Family Income Division of the CDF, Children's Defense Fund. They're both joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. People can help us by just trying to keep their questions brief, but they're certainly welcome. And so you can call 333-9455, a toll-free 800-222-9455, or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And Mary Lee Allen, hello.
Hello.
And Deborah Weinstein, hello.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks very much for talking with us. I would just give you a second to talk a little bit about your organizations. People probably are familiar with the Children's Defense Fund, but just Ms. Allen, just talk for a moment about what's the idea, what's the brief of the Children's Defense Fund?
Certainly. Thank you. The Children's Defense Fund has been advocating for children for close to four decades. We pay particular attention to the needs of poor children, children of color, and children with disabilities, and really work to make a case for leveling the playing field for all children so we can give every child a healthy start, a head start, a fair start, a safe start, and a moral start in life, and also successful passage to adulthood with the help of caring families and communities. So we believe strongly that children don't come in pieces, and that as we look at giving every child the opportunity they need to succeed in life, that we have to look across the range of children's needs.
All right, very good. And Ms. Weinstein, tell us about the Coalition on Human Needs.
Well, the Coalition is an alliance of more than 100 different national organizations, including the Children's Defense Fund, I'm proud to say, also various faith groups and service provider organizations, experts on a variety of issues ranging from children to seniors, and all kinds of different service areas like housing and health care, et cetera. And our unifying point is all of these are concerned about the needs of low-income and vulnerable people.
I've mentioned that the report that we're talking about, the title of the report is State of America's Children, although it really concentrates on on the conditions for black and Hispanic families and black and Hispanic kids. And, you know, in setting a title on our program, I said something like, well, we would talk about the state of minority families. And while we're doing that, it seems to me that there's something important that you talk about in the report, and that is demographics, which and maybe I'll direct this question to Mary Lee Allen, that really makes you question whether using, you know, at what point using the term minority is not going to work anymore.
Certainly, what you're describing is the fact, and a very striking fact. I think our report, The State of America's Children, does paint a devastating portrait of children's needs across our country overall. But when you look at the special needs of minority children or children of color, they become particularly striking when you consider that in 2019, just 8 years from now, children of color will be the majority of children in our country. They're already a majority of children in 9 states and the District of Columbia. And I think it's that fact, the fact that we will be counting on these children of color as the economic drivers of the future, who will be raising their own families, assisting their parents, investing in the economy and in Social Security to keep us all thriving, where we've really raised the alarm bells that we must, in fact, address the challenge facing the children of color in our country. We refer to them as minority children, but when you talk about them being in the majority, obviously that's the situation that we're facing. And 2019, that's only 8 years from now,
yeah,
as we look ahead.
I don't know, Ms. Weinstein, anything you might want to add to that?
I think that it's just an important point that we all need to dwell on. And a lot of the work that we have done talks about the impact, the cost of poverty, not only on the children who grow up poor, but also on the economy as a whole. And so if, you know, as we get into some of these truly alarming and disturbing numbers about the extent of poverty among African-American children, Hispanic or Latino children, and recognizing, again, as Mary Lee says, that they are people we are counting on to be part of our economic future, and how many roadblocks are being set up for them that will make it hard for them to both share in our prosperity and, as Mary Lee says, drive our prosperity in years to come.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, as I mentioned in trying to do a little introduction here, there's a lot of information in this report. So what we thought we would try to do, at least for the purpose of this conversation, maybe we could have some others, but for this conversation, was to try to narrow things down a little bit. And one of the things that I certainly wanted to look at and seems to be a bedrock issue here is poverty. Child poverty. And it certainly, again, maybe I'll ask Mary Lee Allen to talk about this. It is very, very striking. While it is the case there are white children living in poverty, that in significantly greater numbers, black and Hispanic kids are living in poverty.
Absolutely. And I think what's striking, just to sort of start again with all children, which I think is important, Every fifth child in America is poor. One in every five children. And children are also the nation's poorest age group. That means they're more likely to be poor than any other age group. Particularly striking is the fact that child poverty increased almost 10% between 2008 and 2009, which is the most recent data we had. But that was the largest single-year increase since data was first collected. And I think particularly striking, it was the greatest growth there was in Hispanic children. So when we look at the fact that more than one in three black and one in three Hispanic children are poor, that's compared with more than one in 10 white non-Hispanic children.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that there were more Hispanic children than poor black or poor white children, but again, minority children are disproportionately poor when you look across the spectrum. I think another factor here that's particularly important, we talk about poverty, and I think sometimes it's helpful for people ask, well, what do you mean by poverty?
Mm-hmm.
There's the national poverty level that's set, and when you look at a family of four, we're talking about an income of $22,050. So that's the overall poverty level. But when you look at what's happening to poverty in our country, almost half of all poor children live in extreme poverty. That means they look at incomes that are half or less at the poverty level. So consider that, a family of four living on $11,025, or about $32 a day, $230 a week. And again, that's for a family of four. So I think that when we look at poverty, it's also important to look at extreme poverty. And one in six black and one in seven Hispanic children live in extreme poverty, as contrasted with one in 20 white children. But again, anyone living in extreme poverty has those enormous challenges.
Yeah.
I think, let me mention one other thing, because this is relevant in Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
More than half of all poor children and half of those living in extreme poverty live in Illinois and seven other states. So Illinois is up there in terms of the numbers of poor children and the numbers living in extreme poverty.
Yeah. And this, you're going to add something, Ms. Weinstein?
Yeah. If I could.
Please.
I have some data that specifically refers to Illinois, and I know sometimes it can be a little mind-boggling to hear these numbers, but in Illinois, for the same time period that Mary Lee is talking about, 39% of black children were poor, 25% of Latino children were poor, as opposed to 9% of white children. So the levels are shocking, and there's more poverty for younger children, and there's more poverty, unsurprisingly, if it's just a single mom caring for children as opposed to a two-parent family. So if you look in Illinois, look at single moms with the youngest children under age five, and half of them are poor. Half. So this is a gigantic issue.
And this, I expect that some people will want to connect where we are right now with the economic downturn that we've been going through now for a couple of years. No doubt that's made things worse, but would we be talking about this in any case? Are we talking about a long-term trend and not something that's just kind of a blip?
I'll start. There's no question that the recession has made things a lot worse. And that the other thing that we have to know about the problems of poor people and the impact of recessions is that they go on a lot longer. Of course, the economists tell us that we're not now in a recession. And a lot of people, their experience seems very different, and they say, well, I'm struggling. And it's true for low-income people. Recession or even depression-like conditions can go on a lot beyond when the economy as a whole is supposedly on the rebound. And we know that our economic situation is extremely fragile right now. And who knows, we might even be headed back into recession. But for the lowest income people, it goes on a lot longer. Now, you did ask whether these are problems that are persistent, even in good times. And it's true, we've had much too much poverty, even in good times. So we do have a problem that needs to be addressed that will not go away magically all by itself when the economy really is perking along. But we do have to recognize that the aftermath of a bad downturn such as we have experienced and many people feel we're really still in has just tremendously bad consequences to low-income people and especially children.
Hmm. Anything that you, Ms. Allen, you might want to?
No, I think that the thing that's striking here, as you know and your listeners know, on Sunday, August 28th, we'll be celebrating the dedication of a memorial to Dr. Martin Luther King on the Mall in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look back to 1968, child poverty at that time or close to that time in 1969 was at its lowest level. Its lowest level 40 years ago, basically. And as Debbie said, it's continued too high over that time. But there have been periods, and I think this is important, between 1992 and 2000, for example, during that 8 to 9 year period, we saw a drop in poverty, which was about equal then to the increase we've had in the last 9 years. And I think we all expect the numbers to continue to go up. So I think the fact that we now have 15.5 million children adrift in a sea of poverty, and every 32 seconds another child is born poor, you know, this is a crisis that's been going on for some time, and it's really reached a point of not. We've just got to address it as we move ahead.
Yeah. Well, maybe I should just quickly here introduce again the guests. We're talking this morning in this hour of focus with Mary Lee Allen. She is Director of Child Welfare at the Children's Defense Fund. She's the last person you heard. And Deborah Weinstein, she's Executive Director of the Coalition on Human Needs. We're talking about some of the information that you'll find in a recent report issued by the Children's Defense Fund. And it's called The State of America's Children 2011. It has a lot of information here on a range of subjects, child poverty, but also things like child health and education issues and juvenile justice. And if you'd like to read it, you can go to the website of the Children's Defense Fund, and it's there. And we're trying to talk about at least some of the things in this report, in this program, and we've picked up some other areas that we were hoping in future programs here to talk specifically about some other things like health and juvenile justice. But questions, comments, you know, however people want to get involved in the conversation, you can certainly do that. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. You know, something that there's so much here, but it's something that just really it kind of jumps out at me is looking at of these various statistics that I think is particularly very striking is homelessness. And that over the past couple of years, there has been a very significant increase in homeless preschool kids. And then also, again, a very significant increase in the numbers of homeless children that are in public school. Is that something that maybe Ms. Allen, you could say something about?
Certainly, we've been very concerned about those increases, both of preschool homeless children and also homeless children in public schools. I think what's particularly striking here is, however, that what those numbers don't include are those numbers of homeless children who don't get to a preschool or don't get to an elementary school. And around the country, we're hearing stories of striking stories of increasing numbers of homeless families. I know the state of Montana, we have an office in Montana, and we don't have the precise figures here, but as they're beginning to go back to school, they're noting the number of children who no longer have a stable address or have a motel as an address as they're moving forward. So I think what's important is that, all over the country, rural areas, in urban areas, as a result of foreclosures and other sorts of things, we're having children experiencing homelessness in ways they'd never done it before. I don't know if a number of weeks ago, and it was rerun, I think, at that point, 60 Minutes did a very powerful piece on homeless children in Florida, not too far from Disney World, and the group of children sitting around together talking about how it felt to have your electricity cut off, or having to move in with a neighbor because you no longer had a place to live, or having your father go to the street with a sign, "I'm homeless and I need help for my children. Give me a job." So I think this whole issue of homelessness is just typifies the impact of the recession, but also these challenging times that we're facing now. As Debbie mentioned, we're supposed to be moving out of that recession, but certainly the impact on children and families continues to be enormous.
Yeah, I'm sure, and Ms. Weinstein, and no doubt, I haven't looked at the entire list, but I'm sure that among the members of the Coalition on Human Needs, there must certainly be organizations that try, they're trying to address that particular issue, and also others that try to work with struggling families. And I'm sure it must be that they will, if you talk to them, they will report increasing demands on whatever kind of services that they can provide.
Yes, whether it's nutrition or housing and homelessness, health services, many groups all over the country are overwhelmed trying to meet the need. And, you know, it brings me to something that we shouldn't go too much farther without talking about, which is, despite a bad economy, it doesn't have to be this way. There is more that we could be doing to protect children and therefore shore up their ability to do well in school, have proper health so that they don't fall behind and so that they can be contributors in the future to a revived economy. And what is so troubling about today is that the deficit reduction efforts in Congress are all about cutting. And there's a tremendous risk that they will make things far worse instead of protecting children.
I think that's a striking point and something that I'm glad we're getting back to. And I think that when we first started talking, that Mary Lee Allen, you were talking about this, I'm thinking of the fact that when we talk about programs that are designed to try to help people who are struggling, often the question is asked is, well, can we afford to do this? Can we afford that? And it seems that you're trying to encourage people to say, well, look, try to get yourself a little longer frame of reference here. Because while programs like this may have upfront costs, if we can help people to do well, that then the long-term benefit is much, much greater.
Certainly, I think that's so true. And just look at, there are obviously issues that provide basic income and health care support for children. The Medicaid and Children's Health Insurance Program, the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, or SNAP, mental health programs, substance abuse programs, early Head Start and Head Start, programs for education. I think what's particularly important, and as we look forward in terms of addressing this deficit problem, is if we don't continue to invest, not just don't cut, we can have to ensure that these critically important programs aren't cut, but we have to invest in education. Let me, one statistic that just is so striking to me as we look forward in terms of the challenges ahead of us is that nearly 80% or more of Black and Hispanic public school students in the 4th, 8th, and 12th grade are unable to read or do math at grade level, compared to 50% or more of the white children. And when you look nationally, not just at children of color, but all children, it's 60% cannot read or do math at grade level. And in this society, when in fact we have a situation where, it's almost a sentence to social and economic death if by the time you graduate from high school, you can't read. 40% of children don't graduate at all. So I think that if we're serious about the economic future of our country, that we've got to look at this process as a need to invest in services that will allow us to regain that stable foothold in our economy today. Mm-hmm. And that isn't just a high school diploma. That's going beyond a high school diploma. But the challenges ahead of us are enormous. So instead of talking about cutting these key programs that address not only education but early childhood, the connections between investments in early Head Start, in Head Start, in quality child care programs are directly related to children's ability to be ready for school when they get to that age.
We have a caller and who's been patient with us, and so I want to bring them into the conversation. This is someone who is in Urbana and line one. Hello.
Hello. I'm glad you're touching on the income distribution problem. Last night on public radio, there was a professor from, you might guess, the University of Chicago, an economist, who justified the inequality by saying this is what gave the American economy its great vigor and vitality. He seems to ignore that nations with far greater equality in distribution, the Scandinavian nations, Germany, seem to have much more vigorous economies than we have. And our economy seems to spend as much time in depression as it does in normal prosperity. And I just point back to the 1800s and the last century, and if you add up the amount of time that the economy was depressed, you have to have severe questions about just how vigorous and vital our economy has been. Would you care to comment?
Well, go ahead.
Thank you very much. I saw, that might have been on the radio, but on public television last night on the NewsHour, there was a really excellent presentation about inequality and how surprising it is to most Americans to find the very high levels of inequality we have in this country. And the fact is pretty clear that the gigantic growth in concentration of wealth in very, very few hands in this country has accelerated in recent years. These are the same years where our economic growth has been weak. So it simply is not true that rising inequality is sort of the price you have to pay to get economic growth. In fact, I think the opposite is the case, that in periods in this country where prosperity has been more broadly shared, that was true in the 70s and in the 1990s, we had greater economic growth as measured by low unemployment and rising incomes across the board. Right now, as they said in that show yesterday, pretty much all of the economic growth that has occurred in the recent period has gone not even just to the top 1%, but to the top 0.1%. And that is accompanied by pretty much everybody else with stagnating income. So it's an excellent point. And the question is, will we make it worse or better? And cutting out the education programs, housing programs, economic security programs will make things worse.
We are at a point here. We just need to take a quick pause. We're talking about some of what you'll find in a new report that's just been issued by the Children's Defense Fund, looking at the state of America's children for 2011. And we have two guests with us, Deborah Weinstein and Mary Lee Allen. We'll talk some more in just a moment after we take a short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, how rating agencies like Standard & Poor's acquired the influence they have on the economy. The agencies misjudged the risk of mortgage-backed securities. Now S&P is under fire for downgrading U.S. credit. We'll talk with law professor and finance expert Frank Partnoy, who used to work on Wall Street. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
WILL programs are made possible by English Hedge Row, a special event full-service florist on the corner of University and Lincoln Avenue, Urbana. English Hedge Row delivers distinctive bouquets, plants, and gift baskets throughout the Champaign-Urbana area.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. We are here Monday through Friday and have 2 hours each morning. We explore different topics. Tomorrow morning on the show, we'll talk about the man who was the president in the period running up to the U.S. Civil War, the 13th president. His name was Millard Fillmore. Probably a lot of people don't really know very much about him, but he certainly was a key figure in that time and arguably was a man who was not up to the task of being president at one of the most difficult times in American history. We'll find out more about him as we talk with Paul Finkelman, who's professor of law and public policy at the Albany Law School and author of a new brief biography of Fillmore. And then we'll talk again about some of the current economic issues here in the country, talking about the federal budget deficit and related issues on Thursday, tomorrow, in the 11 o'clock hour. Our guest there will be Neil Buchanan. He's professor of law at the George Washington University Law School. You can look at the schedule, listen to past programs by going to the website, our website, will.illinois.edu. In this hour, we're talking about some of what you'll find in a new report, The State of America's Children 2011, issued by the Children's Defense Fund. There's a lot of information there. If you'd like to read it, go to their website and you can look at it. Our guests are this morning Mary Lee Allen. She is Director of Child Welfare for the Children's Defense Fund. And Deborah Weinstein. She's Executive Director of the Coalition on Human Needs. And again, questions welcome. We do have some people here standing by. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And you can also send us an email if you like, will-talk at illinois.edu. Or I guess it's a hyphen, will-talk. And we will take another caller here, someone on a cell phone on our line four. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Great show. Very, very important topic. Thank you for taking my call. You know, most of the time you have stories on, and I like to think that there's a solution, or at least maybe possible solution down the road. You know, you can kind of extrapolate the problem. I just don't see, and maybe your guests can talk to this, I just don't see, given the numbers, this thing turning around, you know, given the out-of-wedlock birth rates for some portions of the population, and mentioning the chances of a child coming from a single parent, and it's this thing being, you know, almost systemic in its effect on our culture and the status of our country. What I'm noticing, just an observation, is what's happening is these children are almost being, they're losing their childhood. They're losing their adolescence because of the information age. They know at a very, very young age that there's, like, no possibility for hope or no possibility for positive change. And I think it's just a very damning comment on our culture and the future prospects of the country at large. It's incredibly scary out there. And I'm just wondering if your guest thinks that, you know, this thing can turn around, or if the country as a whole is just going to find itself in a brand new universe in the future. And I'll listen off there.
Well, I appreciate the comment here. The caller sort of makes a kind of a general point and a kind of a specific point. And he does point to one of the areas that I wanted to make sure that at least we touch on. Maybe we do that and then get to the larger point. This the issue of the numbers of children, of black kids particularly, who live with only one parent. And maybe Mary Lee, maybe you can touch on that.
Certainly. I think the challenges as we look at children overall, today about 70% of all children live with two parents, but fewer than 40% of black children live with two parents. So that gives you a sense of the contrast. Black children are more than twice as likely as white children and almost twice as likely as Hispanic children to live with neither parent. So certainly the challenges facing two-parent families today are enormous. The families facing single-parent families today are even more enormous when we look at the things that are there. It's important, though, when we're thinking about these numbers, that there are so many things that impact the lives of these children. So when we look at poverty rates, for example, poverty rates are very high for single-parent families with children, but they're even higher if the family has not graduated from high school. They're even higher if, in fact, the child dropped out, the mother dropped out much earlier. So I think it's so important to not develop a sense of it's overwhelming, there's nothing we can do. The alarm bells are out there. We've got it. This has got to be a wake-up call, not only to our political leaders, who can take action now, but to everyone in America. And I hope we'll have an opportunity to talk more about the challenges and the opportunities in Washington now to address these problems, but also opportunities at the state and local level, but also things that individuals can do as we move forward. Because, again, we can't be ready to write off these children. We all want to see our children do better in the future than we did, and that's the challenge we have in moving forward.
Yeah. Well, I'll turn over and give Deborah Weinstein a chance maybe to again, comment on the same thing here. And, you know, I find we started out talking about poverty, and the thing is that things very quickly get all tangled up. If someone's poor, that will affect where they can live, and that will affect where their kids go to school, and that will affect the quality of education that they get, and that will affect their opportunity to go on and get a good job. And if people are poor, that will affect their ability to have health care for their kids, and will affect their ability to work because it might affect their ability to get child care for the kids. And very quickly, you start piling one thing on top of another, and you wonder, now, however do you dig yourself out from under all of that?
Well, you're right. You know, all my life I've wanted to sort of boil down the solution to a bumper sticker or something and have not ever managed to do that. But the one thing that maybe comes close to being on a bumper sticker is that in past decades, we have made considerable progress in reducing poverty. So the caller, who's very thoughtful in his question, but at least can I offer the encouragement that in the 70s, in the 90s, we had considerable reduction in poverty. And certainly it was helped by a stronger economy, but it wasn't the economy alone. There were choices made, such as, for instance, to increase the tax credits that are available to low-income families, like the earned income tax credit and the child tax credit. Those lift families out of poverty. Even very recently, here we're in this awful economy where we would have expected that the amount of families or individuals experiencing lack of food, you know, not being able to afford enough food, would skyrocket just as poverty actually rose. But because we took the step at the federal level to increase food stamps, essentially, that was a major driver, that at least between 2008 and 2009, the amount of hunger or inability to afford enough food did not rise. That tells us there are things we can do and should make us particularly angry to think that Congress will now turn away from offering that help and instead start cutting things.
Just picking up on that for a minute, David, mm-hmm. I think mm-hmm. it's also important to look at the health area. Certainly the passage of the Affordable Care Act built upon important gains that have been made with the establishment of Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program in beginning to reduce the number of children in our country who are uninsured. There's still far too many, but we also know that there are strategies that can be put in place by getting schools working together with health departments in getting those children involved. So I think in the early childhood area too, with the expansions of Head Start and Early Head Start, still far too short in terms of what needs to be done, but we've seen enormous impacts. More recently in the education area, there are a number of states that have undertaken very extensive race to the top initiatives to really look comprehensively at how do you improve the quality of care overall in your communities, but looking particularly at the need for every child to achieve. So we know what works, which is very different than 20, 30 years ago in terms of some of these areas. And what we need to do is to move forwards, not backwards, both at the federal and state level as we move ahead.
Let's talk with someone else who is listening. In Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I'll just quickly make this statement. My takeaway from the program last night, wealth inequality with the lower 40%, which you've been concentrating on, having only 0.3% of the wealth compared with the top 20%, having 84% of the wealth compared with Sweden, the lower 40% has 26% of the wealth. You know, my issue is that the income inequalities and that. So I know you're focusing on some of these other things, but the overriding issue. So anyway, in terms of comment, I'll go off here.
All right. I appreciate the comment. I don't know if either you want to talk more about that, Ms. Weinstein?
I think it is a stunning set of statistics, and the caller knows from watching it last night that most Americans, or at least the ones who were surveyed, were very much surprised to learn the true extent of the inequality in this country. A lot of it makes you go back to, you know, the sort of statements out of Congress and the absolute refusal to raise revenues from that very top group that has been just, you know, been shoveled money at for a number of years now, decades really, but it's accelerated hugely, especially since the Bush-era tax cuts were passed. And so right now we're looking at these choices. Are we going to, cut home energy assistance, heating assistance, when it gets cold again, as it most certainly will, and preserve, for about the same amount of money, we can choose either retaining that energy assistance for families so they don't become sick and in the winter time, or we can preserve subsidies for oil and gas companies who are, you know, making these enormous profits. And there are another example, Warren Buffett said the other day that, you know, I think I should pay more taxes. My tax rate is around 17%. Everybody else who works for me is taxed at a higher rate. Because he pays his taxes on things like capital gains instead of straightforward earnings, and that rate is so much lower, if we equalize that, that could be $500 billion in revenues over 10 years. That could pay for quite a lot of education and nutrition aid and housing aid and jobs so that people could work and raise their children. The inequality just says to us that there are a very small number of people in this country, some of whom would be willing to pay more and certainly can afford to pay more, and it would help us invest in progress for everyone.
Hmm. Well, do you just, we've talked about the fact that there are programs, there have been programs designed to try to help people who are struggling. There's SNAP, which is the program that's there to try to help people put food on the table. And there's the Earned Income Tax Credit for very low-income people. And, you know, there are a variety of things like that that at least are supposed to provide this kind of floor to help people who are struggling. There, though, in your mind, maybe I'll go to Mary Lee Allen, in your mind, is there some chance that things like that there might be cutbacks in the Earned Income Tax Credit, or that something like SNAP, there won't be as much money going into it in the near future as there is now?
I think absolutely. We are very concerned that we're going to see the programs like Medicaid and CHIP and SNAP and the programs you mentioned cut back in the course of the efforts around deficit reduction and the super committee that's been put forward. What's so critically important is, as Debbie was emphasizing, that the deficits that we're addressing don't grow from spending by themselves. They grow from the mismatch between spending and revenues. And the tax revenues today is at the lowest percentage of our gross domestic product as it's been since 1950. So as we look at the opportunities that are there for Congress to address this deficit, they have got to protect the programs that are investing in children and families and others and moving them forward, and instead look at the tax side and move forward in terms of changing some of the tax rates, closing the corporate loopholes that result in a number of corporations paying no taxes at all as they move forward. But we are extremely concerned, and I think the message has to be loud and clear that we can have no cuts and program changes in these key safety net programs for poor children in our country.
We just have about 5-6 minutes left, and I have a number of callers, so we'll try to get at least one or two in the time that remains. And the next in line is someone in Danville. This is line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I was curious as to what your guests might have to say about the impact of free trade on everything that you're talking about, and if you all just listen off the line. Thank you very much.
Okay. Well, maybe I'll ask Deborah Weinstein, just because there are so many organizations as part of your organization, Coalition for Human Needs. I don't know. Are there people who are interested in trade issues?
Yes. We have a number of economic experts, like the Economic Policy Institute, for instance, who are experts. And it would be better to talk directly to them. But I think that the economists that I talk to want to see trade, but they want to see conditions so that workers in this country are protected, and frankly, workers in all countries are protected, so that other countries can have an unfair advantage because their workers are paid so little, have no benefits. So if there are some protections, conditions on opening up trade doors so that our workers aren't victimized, then it can be beneficial. It hasn't always been beneficial when the doors have been open without any of those protections. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, indeed, that's probably worthy of an entire hour.
Right. Absolutely.
Some different guests. Let me go one more here. We've got a caller on a cell phone here, line four. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Really good conversation, though I can't listen to it without feeling very sad. One thing that always seems to strike me is that, a lot of callers call in, and listening to the guests, I get the feeling that, like myself, they believe that if you just state what the cost is for keeping, like Bush-era tax cuts in place, that people will say, okay, you're right, it's not worth sending, millions of children deeper into poverty. But I think at some point we need to face the fact that for a great many other people, it is worth it. I don't know what they get out of it, but talking to, relatives and friends who have kind of, drifted over to the right under the Tea Party banner, or however, whatever they want to call it. I think at some point, people who want to keep these programs alive have to find a way to start a conversation to figure out why. Why is it that taxes upon, wealthy people are considered punishment, but that taking away benefits from kids is not? And I never hear that as part of the conversation. I don't know what the answer is, but I think it should happen at some point. That's all.
All right. Again, well, I appreciate the comment. I'll hand that one to Mary Lee Allen. I don't know if you want to.
I basically agree, and I do know there has been some good polling. We have people like Warren Buffett who's speaking out in terms of you can tax me and should be taxing others like me. But we also, there's been some good polling recently in terms of overall impact and people saying they're willing to have taxes increased if it means that we would be able to protect key programs for children and others from cuts. So I think that there's some positive things that are out there, and people are speaking up. And I think the major challenge here is we have letting people know what critical decisions are about to be made, and that if we're serious about not leaving whole groups of children behind who are becoming our nation's majority, we're going to end up condemning our entire nation to failure. The economic implications of all of this are enormous.
Yeah. Just as a way of kind of finishing up, I'm going to, for a second at least, I want to go back to Deborah Weinstein. I'm certainly sympathetic with something you said earlier about how you'd been on this lifelong search to boil things, the solution to the problems, down to the point where you could put it on a bumper sticker, develop our unified field theory of fighting poverty. But if I just said, well, if you just give me a couple of bullet points as to where you would say, okay, we've got to start someplace. So let's start here. Is there a way that you can do that and point to something really concrete to say, okay, here's the place to start?
I know you want a substantive answer, but with the short amount of time and thinking about the last question, I think that we will make the most progress if the majority of people who in polling say that they don't want to cut these programs for low-income kids or older people either, if we do better in reaching them and helping them to participate in the process, that we can turn things around. You know, why are we continuing to have this protection of the richest people while we're talking about cuts for poor children and poor everyone? It's because of the power of money in this country and the influence that has in Congress. But there are large numbers of people who don't believe that way, who don't believe in the Tea Party ideology. We need to do better to reach them, and that's a hard job, but that is what will turn this situation around.
Okay. Well, you know, I'm sorry to say we're at the point we're going to have to stop for right at the moment. I'm sure we'll have some more conversation about these issues. And in fact, what we want to try to do is to draw on again on some of the other areas of the report that we've mentioned for some future conversations. But for right now, I certainly, again, want to say to people, if you're interested in exploring this issue, one thing that you might do is go to the website of the Children's Defense Fund and take a look at this report, The State of America's Children 2011. There's a great deal of a wealth of information about the issues that we're talking about here, child poverty, family structure, child health, education, and so forth. So you can take a look at that, and also you'll find out more about the Children's Defense Fund in the process. And we want to say thanks to Mary Lee Allen. She is Director of Child Welfare at the Children's Defense Fund. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And also Deborah Weinstein. She's the Executive Director of the Coalition on Human Needs. They have a website. You can find out what they're all about by going to that website as well. And Ms. Weinstein, thank you.
Thank you, Congress. But there are large numbers of people who don't believe that way, who don't believe in the Tea Party ideology. We need to do better to reach them, and that's a hard job. But that is what will turn this situation around.
Okay. Well, you know, I'm sorry to say we're at the point we're going to have to stop for right at the moment. I'm sure we'll have some more conversation about these issues. And in fact, what we want to try to do is to draw on again on some of the other areas of the report that we've mentioned for some future conversations. But for right now, I certainly, again, want to say to people, if you're interested in exploring this issue, one thing that you might do is go to the website of the Children's Defense Fund and take a look at this report, The State of America's Children 2011. There's a great deal of a wealth of information about the issues that we're talking about here, child poverty, family structure, child health, education, and so forth. So you can take a look at that, and also you'll find out more about the Children's Defense Fund in the process. And we want to say thanks to Mary Lee Allen. She is Director of Child Welfare at the Children's Defense Fund. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And also Deborah Weinstein. She's the Executive Director of the Coalition on Human Needs. They have a website. You can find out what they're all about by going to that website as well. And Ms. Weinstein, thank you.
Thank you.
WILL programs are made possible by the University of Illinois School of Music, presenting the Allerton Music Barn Festival, September 1st through 5th at Allerton Park. More information is available at www.allertonmusicbarn.com.
We're on the web at will.illinois.edu. That's where you can listen. You can check up on the schedule that we'll be doing here in the weeks ahead. Listen to past programs. Let us know what you're thinking about the shows that you hear and the topics that we cover. That's all on our website, will.illinois.edu. Right now, we'll turn things over to Celeste Quinn, who is the host of the Afternoon Magazine, and she'll be with you for the next hour.
Thank you very much, David. It is a minute and a half before noon. You're tuned to Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3. Urbana. Let's take a look at commodity prices in Kansas City. September wheat, 828 and three quarters. That's up 11 and a quarter. December, 852 and a half, up 10 and three quarters. September wheat in Chicago, up 9 and three quarters at 734 and a half. The December contract, 762 and three quarters, up 10 and three quarters. September corn, 716 and a quarter, up 2 1/4. December, 729 and a half, up 2. March, 742 and a quarter, up 2. May, 746 and a quarter, up 1 1/4. September soybeans, 1356 and 3/4, up 16 and 3/4. November, 1366 and 3/4, up 17 and a quarter. January, 1377 and a half, up 17 and a quarter. March, 1385, up 18 and a quarter. September soybean meal, 354, that is up 270. September soybean oil, 55.70, up 70. August live cattle, 115.80, down 210. October, 117.75, down 242 and a half. August feeder cattle, 134.35, down 122 and a half. September, 135.55, down 182 and a half. October lean hogs, 87.95, that's down 145. Outside markets, September crude oil, 87.90, up 125. The U.S. dollar, 73.68, that's down 33. The CRB index, 334.46.